Hello there.
You listening to Trek FM?
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole, coming at you from, I thought Eternia was going to look a lot better than this, but I'm just one of the hosts, Matthew Rushing, so excited to have back with me Rye Paulson. Rye, didn't you think Eternia was going to look, more eternal?
Yeah, I remembered it more fondly the last time I had jumped in there, but this time it wasn't the best.
We need to spruce this place up, but we are going to be digging into the original Masters of the Universe as we get ready for the remake, so from 1987. But before we do that, of course, you can find us wherever you get podcasts, and you can subscribe so you'll make sure you'll get the shows as soon as they come out. You can also find us over on social media. We're on X, Twitter at the 602 Club. You can also interact with us and follow us over on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. The entire network is also on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. There's also a listeners only discussion group you can find there called the Babel Conference, as well as finding our brand new website at tfm.fan. So you can see all of the episodes and shows that we've got out there. But, I wanted to ask you this, Rye. Obviously, we're covering this because the new movie is coming out. In fact, as we're recording this, it is already out because we're recording on a Friday, and the movie is already dropped, of course, for the early release on Thursdays. And so, but what's your just kind of history with Masters of the Universe? I mean, obviously, the cartoon came out before you were born. And so, like, was this something that you're really familiar with? Did you go back and watch the cartoon? Did you care about Masters of the Universe at all before you saw, hey, they're doing a new film?
Yeah, so I have seen the entire cartoon that came out in the 80s.
Nice.
I loved it.
It's two seasons, right?
Yeah, two or three, something like that. It's nice and short. But I loved He-Man, Masters of the Universe, and I remember watching it religiously. I know some way, whether it's in my garage or at my parents' house still, I have the entire show on physical media, and I would watch it a lot. It's been a while since I've, the story's a little fuzzy, but I have this, deep love for the character of He-Man. One of my prize, not like it's actually worth anything, but prize, like Funko Pops is my He-Man Funko Pop. Like, I love the character of He-Man. I think the universe is fun. Well, the animated universe is fun. And so when they were like, there's a new movie, I'm like, all right, hopefully they don't mess this up, because I do love this. And not knowing that there was a 1987 movie that maybe already did mess it up. But, so, yeah, I had a very long history. Just grew up watching it. I think it's because my dad liked it. And he's like, you should watch this. And then I remember I was definitely, addicted to it at a time when I was probably, 8 to 10 is my guess. Maybe a little later. But, yeah. What is your experience with He-Man?
Yeah, this is really interesting, because obviously grew up in the time period where the show was on. And what I remember most about the show is my parents wouldn't let me watch it.
Okay.
Everybody knows who's listened to the show long enough. I come from a pretty conservative background, and my parents were just like, nope, that's not a show for you to watch. Of course, it was evil. But I remember the most is that my friend across the street had all the toys. He had Grayskull Castle, and he had all of the characters, and man, I loved playing with the toys over at his house. And to me, that was the thing that really sticks with me the most, is that, which is, I know, very funny. But obviously, you know, this is the 80s when cartoons literally were there just to sell toys. Like, that was the point of the cartoon. You know, they created a cartoon so they could sell you toys.
Right.
And there's nothing really wrong with that in many ways. I mean, it's super fun.
Yep.
And, you know, if the toys are good enough, in a lot of ways, I think that the cartoon just enhances that for a kid, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's strangely enough, that's my history with this series. And so I've never gone back and watched the cartoon. I haven't had the time.
Yeah.
I think it would be fun to go back and do that. But yeah, I just never gotten the opportunity to really sit down and watch it at this point. But I have those fond memories of being a kid and being at my friend's house across the street and playing with the toys. And there was always something really fun about them, right? Because, I mean, you know, there's something about this series that's just kind of whacked out, right? Like, you know, you've got green tigers and, you know, you got this cool looking castle and you've got a weird mixture of technologies and, you know, you've got swords but ray guns all at the same time. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, obviously you've seen the cartoon, your dad really liked it and everything, but what was it about the series that, you know, kept your interest? What was it that really captured your imagination as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to remember a little bit because obviously it was a while ago, but I remember, similar to you, I remember the toys. I even just looked up. I definitely have some of these toys that are listed on eBay for hundreds of dollars. I definitely have some of those in my garage, which is crazy. But I just remember, like, thinking the character of He-Man was just like the coolest dude. I just was like, this guy rocks. He rides a green tiger that like wears like
this, I mean, what's not to love?
Like this has like this, like this red mask that goes down his back and all that. And I remember when they, like, She-Ra became a thing, and they introduced her in a different show or in that show. I don't remember when she gets introduced, but and they just had all these like fun names of these characters, like Man-at-Arms, Teela, Beastman, Trapjaw, Mirrorman, Evil Lyn. Like, these are all very, just for me, like very memorable characters. Even though I don't remember the story all that much, I would, like you said, I would love to go back and watch it just to, you know, I'm sure I'd get like a wave of nostalgia. But I thought Skeletor was like very cool as a villain. And then honestly, it was mostly He-Man. And then I think it's Battle Cat. Yeah. I think it's Battle Cat.
Yeah.
Just, I was like 10 and like, this is all life should be about, is about this.
No, I mean, I think in many ways that just makes complete sense. Right. And I think part of it, you know, when I think about the show and just the toys in general, like, one of the things about that was just, it's how colorful it all is,
yeah,
right?
You know,
as a kid, like, it makes sense that this captured our imagination because it's just super colorful. The world is kind of in Technicolor, right?
In
many ways. Like, it's just a world of Technicolor. And so obviously the origins then of this movie were, you know, the toy line. It started in 1982. And you had the cartoon there from 83 to 85. And they had a animated film that had come out in 1985.
Yes.
But then they decided to shift here and do a live action film. And what's really interesting, too, is that, like, reading up on this, there was so much more to the movie originally. Like, they were originally going to have his mom be from Earth, so there was a stronger connection. This movie seemed to have much more to it in its original script form. And I just wanted to ask you just kind of about that and the story and bringing this to film, because I don't know about you, but I'm watching this movie and I'm thinking, man, if you don't really know the cartoon, I'm not sure that the movie does a great job of translating this to the big screen in live action to make these characters kind of matter to you and what their story is and what's happening even.
Yeah. As someone who loved it, and I've definitely seen that movie, the 85 movie. I've definitely seen that.
Yeah.
And I don't remember anything story-wise. Like, I remember some lore, kind of. And I remember the character, He-Man, and all these characters, like we said. But, like, when I jumped into this, I was like, what is going on? Like, you pretty much just jump into, like, there's a crap ton of stuff happening. And yeah, like, if you haven't seen it, you know, if you're 20 and, you know, you didn't watch it as a kid because you were, you know, whatever age, 16 when it came out, like, you weren't gonna know what's going on. They just kind of assume that you've got like the lore down, and understand the character of He-Man. There's no, like, you know, there's movies where you do this really good where it's like, all right, we don't need a huge lore dump on who He-Man is, how he became He-Man, like all this stuff. Which is fine in essence when you're doing it for the Fantastic Four last year, right? Where you got, everyone knows the Fantastic Four. You don't need to do a backstory. You do a 30-second montage on how they got their powers. You're good to go because people know the character. And at least for me watching this, I'm sure people probably felt this way back when it came out. Like, what is going on? Like, this is a kid's cartoon, a kid's action figure. What is happening? And that's what I felt even going into it this time I watched it. I was like, I don't remember what's going on. I obviously understand the concept of He-Man, so I'm like, okay, I can like do better than that. But if you got no idea, it'd be hard. I'm curious what you thought. You haven't seen the show or anything like that. Like, when you came into this movie, what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, that, and the reason that I asked you, and I think it's really interesting because, you know, you have much more context than I do, but I do think it's just a strange decision, I think, to drop everybody in to a universe like this with really no context. Like, there's no preamble. There's nothing. Like, it does feel like that this movie would have really benefited. I mean, clearly this film is stealing from things like Flash Gordon, Star Wars, all of that kind of stuff,
yeah,
right?
100%.
And this movie would have clearly been better, I think, if they had just given you a text introduction. You know, like,
yeah, it's like a crawl, you know?
Yeah, some kind of introduction like that. Because I think that's one of the mistakes that they make in this film, is that they drop you into the action. Like, you're just in the middle of what's happening. And I then, as a viewer, like, I have some context for He-Man being the good guy, Skeletor's the bad guy. Like, it's obvious in that sense. But it's hard then, as a viewer, to what are these characters' motivations? Like, yeah, what's driving them, you know, and to make them more than just good avatar, bad avatar, and all of that, and to put any kind of flesh on the bone. And I think, you know, just thinking kind of constructively and critically about the film, one of the things that this movie could have done a good job of is, you know, if you had a little bit more context, and even just at the opening having some sort of crawl or, you know, text explanation of what's happening.
Yeah.
That would have been, I think, beneficial.
Yeah, I love the idea of jumping into a universe. Like, we get so many origins that, like, jumping in's great. But, like, the reason, like Star Wars obviously is the prime example of 1977, where George Lucas created a entire universe, and New Hope starts with, a crap ton of stuff has already happened. Here's what it is. And then you jump in. It gives you enough context with the opening crawl and all that. Like, here's information. All right. Now you can like take a grasp on it. And then it's obviously written well. So like you pick up on things pretty easily. But this is just puts you right there and like figure it out, man. And then the writing is not New Hope 1977. So,
well, I think that's a great a point about, you know, one of the things about Star Wars that I think helps people come into it, you know, I remember watching it for the first time as a kid, is that all of the words that are used too are words that make sense to us. When you say empire, evil empire in yeah. the crawl,
mm-hmm.
that makes sense. You know, yep. when you have a rebellion, those words all make sense, mm-hmm. right? And so much of what they're doing too here in the Masters of the Universe world creation is they're utilizing a lot of terms that don't make sense to us. It's like, you know, there is a minor bit at the very beginning about like Eternia and Grayskull and all that. Like it's not that that doesn't exist in the film, mm-hmm. but I think what it doesn't do is it doesn't really set up like, okay, who is Skeletor, right?
Right.
And who is like He-Man and why does he matter and all of this stuff. And part of that just it throws you into the action and it hopes that, you know, at some point you'll catch up. And I think, you know, reading that there were some greater connections here to the two worlds
mm-hmm.
would have made a lot more sense then as to why Earth kind of would matter even to the character of He-Man, right? Yeah. Like him being there and him finding himself there would have been really interesting then. Mm-hmm. And instead, again, I just don't think we get that. And that's disappointing, you know? Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about this too, because this is really interesting. Obviously, Dolph Lundgren is playing He-Man. He's the character, the champion of Eternia. And the movie is called Masters of the Universe, right? It's not called like He-Man, Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
But dude, who is this character? Even after, that's one of the things watching the film I was thinking is like, they absolutely don't give He-Man anything to really do. And he barely yeah. has any lines in the film. So it's yeah. it was a very strange thing. Again, like as I'm watching this movie, I'm like, man, if you're coming into this and you just kind of have a vague understanding, it's like, I don't get as a viewer a reason to connect with the character because you don't actually allow the character to have a part other than just basically being like the cardboard cutout good guy.
Yeah, and I wondered why. Obviously, like, Dolph Lundgren is He-Man. And, I mean, he's not exactly a great actor, at least in my opinion. I don't know what most people think. He's good in Rocky, I guess. But it's almost like, yeah, they didn't care to get a guy that could, like, act. And they just right. got a
they
guy.
They just needed a big guy.
This guy, big guy that put a wig on him or made him grow out his hair. Be like, hey, you mm-hmm. look like He-Man. Cool. Run around with a sword and no clothes and we'll be good. Because then they had everybody else. Like the entire plot is driven by supporting characters pretty much. Mm-hmm. Like you said, yes. there's almost yep. no dialogue from He-Man himself. I guess I don't remember the cartoon super well, but like He-Man was the guy. He was the guy. Like he was your titular hero, right? Like, and so watching this, you're like, all right, this guy's boring. Like he's just, and a lot of this movie takes place on.
He's
Earth.
Very bland.
Yeah, he's bland. There's nothing to him, and it looks silly on Earth, like very silly. And then a lot of the plot is centered around the teenagers on Earth, Courtney Cox and whoever else. And I remember that I was doing something while watching, and I came back and I was like, Earth. I was like, I know there was, but this was like a jarring, like, all right, here's our 80s teen movie now in the middle of it. I was like, what is going on? This is so dumb. And so, yeah, it's, yeah, I guess it's fair to call it a Masters of the Universe, but like, He-Man's your guy. It's like doing a Star Wars movie and Luke Skywalker in A New Hope is just like, I'll help you in the background. Like, it just doesn't make sense. So it was frustrating. I mean, I guess not frustrating. I didn't care that much because the movie wasn't, I didn't have crazy expectations or anything like that, but it still was like, what are we doing?
Yeah. I mean, it's a strange thing. And I think again, kind of like thinking through the lens of like what helps make a movie successful, what helps you draw an audience into the story and everything. And what really does that obviously are characters that you care about. And, you know, when your kind of main character is not given an opportunity to really do anything or say anything that helps you connect with them,
right,
other than kind of swinging a sword around every once in a while, I think that's a really difficult thing. And, you know, you mentioned the idea of, you know, the teen movie aspect to this. So you get Courtney Cox and you get Robert Duncan McNeil, mm-hmm. who I just know from Star Trek Voyager. Those two characters. In many ways, the movie revolves around them much more and what their experience with, you know, the two universes colliding, right? The universe of Eternia and the universe of Earth colliding, and, you know, how their lives are impacted by this kind of smash up.
Uh-huh.
And it is fascinating because we know more about them and who they are and what is going on with them than we ever actually find out about He-Man.
Yeah.
Which is such a strange, like the fact that they're about to break up because, you know, she's going to be going away and all of this stuff. Like, again, we just end up knowing so much more about them as characters than we ever, you know, get with our quote unquote main character of
He-Man. Yeah. 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 It's odd. Obviously, they're clearly, it's like we've been talking about, they're assuming that we already know stuff about He-Man. Which is a mistake. But even if we do, it's like you still need to like continue to build out the character. And it literally just feels obvious they just wanted a cardboard cutout of the guy. Because there's not much to he does stuff, but it's not really like impacting the plot in any meaningful ways. He has no arc whatsoever. I mean, he just does stuff. With no like actual, what's the right word? There's no like depth to his character in any sense. When if you watch the show, like he's like a good, you know, he's supposed to be good. He's fighting against evil. Like, you know, there's things to his character that make him obviously compelling to kids. And so, yeah, it's quite disappointing when, yeah, watching him just kind of walk around, run around, just being big.
Well, and I think it's interesting too because, you know, you end up with the character then of Gwildor, and it's another thing that mm-hmm. is kind of thrown at you here with the film, and you don't really get it explained as to, you know, this idea of this cosmic key and, you know, who even this character is and why he really matters. And it, and the same thing is with Man at Arms or Teela. You know, they're just like these characters who are there along for the ride, but I'm not really given a reason other than kind of knowing, hey, they're on He-Man's side, they're good people, mm-hmm. and they're trying to fight Skeletor, who's the bad guy.
Yeah.
And I, look, you know, I also get that there is something about the way that they did, you know, 80s films.
Totally.
This just isn't a part of the plan. But the other aspect of this is that even judging it against 80s films, you know, there are plenty of great 80s movies that we still watch and love that have stories and characters that we connect with and we care about.
Mm-hmm.
And it does truly just feel like that they could never find a page to be on that allowed us to really grow into the story. And it all just felt very rote in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with you. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to grasp, I think, with all of these characters. They all feel very wooden. They all feel very just there. The teenagers are given the most to do, I guess, with in terms of like depth. And like you were saying, like, the problem isn't necessarily like corny dialogue, which this does have, of course, but 80s movies had some corny dialogue, but also like they were also like, it's kind of just how they were made. Like 80s movies were just kind of written that way, but they were still written in a way that was smart and extremely enjoyable. Like we keep talking about Star Wars. That's a great example of an 80s movie that, you know, is got some corny dialogue, sure, but no one really talks about it like that, at least the originals, because it's written so well, and you connect with the characters and you love the story. And here you're just kind of like bouncing from scene to scene, you know. It's like, all right, guy on screen, tell me what's going on. Okay, we'll go do it. Okay, next thing. Like, it's just so wooden and jarring every time. Like, as I was watching, I'm just like, feel like I had whiplash going around this movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's hard to, when you have that, it's hard. Like, I mean, it's like the most impossible thing to try to like actually connect with and like care about anything that's going on when that's the reality of what's, how the the story and how the script is written.
Well, and that affects too, like the villains, because you know, Frank Langella playing Skeletor, you know, I feel bad for him because like I can tell that he's trying, and of course the makeup doesn't help him, because
oh my gosh,
you know, they you know, the production value, we'll talk about a little bit of this film later, but you know, it just doesn't really help him in that sense. You know, you got Evil Lynn, Meg Foster playing that character. And again, I think in a lot of ways, what is true about the He-Man character is also very true about, you know, the Skeletor and the Evil Lynn character, which is bad person.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't like them. They're trying to do bad things. We got to stop them. And you know, there's no deeper kind of motivation to that, you know. And that is, you know, if you're just taking it on a complete surface level, it's like, okay, you know, this is one of those films, like, it's like, there are parts of it where you can, like, legit just turn off your brain.
Yep.
And kind of watch what's coming at you in screen and have a kind of like, a nostalgia for, in some sense.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you're not going to be given any other reason to truly like connect or care. And what's weird is that like there is a moment in the film where the sorceress who's been you know, captured by Skeletor says, you know, that men who crave power look back over the mistakes of their lives, pile them together, and call it destiny. It's like, it's such an interesting statement, right? And it's a really interesting philosophical idea of like how we look at the world and how we kind of think about our lives in general. And you know, they just don't really, the movie is not interested in doing anything with it. And yet they opened the door for there to be more. And yet they you know, it's said, and then you just completely move on from it. And it's one of those things where it's like, when I hear that, I'm like, oh man, there is a spot where somebody actually had something to say, but we don't actually allow that to be fleshed out in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it's funny because you can just like imagine like the writer's room, like, Oh, that's good, guys. Let's write that down. Put that in there. That's some good stuff. And then they're like, what should we do about it? Nothing. Let's just move on. Like, it's just like, what is going on? Like, why? It's just aggravating. Where that's a very interesting statement. It adds a lot to Skeletor. Like, Skeletor, that he craves power. Like, that is his whole thing. His thing in the show is there's like hardly any other villain. I don't even remember if there's any other villains. It's just He-Man and Skeletor going at it, which is just fun because it's just like, which you don't, a lot of things don't do anymore. You have like villains like rogue galleries out the wazoo. But it's like He-Man versus Skeletor, good versus evil, the whole thing. And it's fun because you have this character who's all good and this character who's all evil, just craving power and like wants to take over. And it's this guy defending Eternia and defending the world and with his, you know, his crew. And yeah, it's like knowing what you know about Skeletor, having someone say that to him could cause this like ripple effect and cause like this, you know, depth to the character that would make him more compelling, at least in this movie specifically. But when you don't address it, it just ends up being a cool statement that just be kind of is like a truth maybe for just us as the audience and doesn't really matter for the characters in the movie. Yeah. So,
yeah. You know, I think one of the things that is really interesting about this becomes the fact that, you know, the Golan and Globus era of canon films, you know, they were, you know, really known, right, for these movies that they would take and they would just make them and they would put them on the screen. And it was just like trying to get films out, and they were just trying to get as many out as possible. And I think it clearly kind of shows that the goal was to produce something that got on screen. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't about trying to really give us any kind of depth. And I mean, if you look through, you know, the films that they made, you know, I mean, gosh, they're also the same group that's obviously responsible for, like, you know, Superman, The Quest of Peace, you know, and things of that nature. They weren't known for movies that really dug into anything. And what's also kind of sad too is like, there is this moment at the very end where there's another great phrase, you know, that talks about this idea of being, you know, that life is a journey, that it's to the journey that we're going to bid you farewell. You know, there's an old Eternian saying, live the journey, for every destination is but a doorway to another. And what's great about that is there truly is truth to that.
Mm-hmm,
there,
yeah.
And it's like, man, I just wish that the movie and this is just slightly more fleshed out, because of course they say it to Kevin and Julie, mm-hmm. right? And their journey with Eternia mm-hmm. crashing into Earth in this way has led them to take another journey, which is to find their journey together instead mm-hmm. of separately, which was what it was about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it just makes me wish that there was, you know, again, you come down to it and thinking about the movie kind of in a constructively critical lens, it's to say mm-hmm. like, man, there is stuff here that if you took this script and then kind of worked all these themes into all of this, you know, you would have had a completely different type of film. And I think a movie that instead of being a kind of silly cult classic as it is, I think it would have had more resonance, you know, if you just had a scriptwriter who was really able to come in and, you know, bring this together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you needed. You need someone that had some chops to make this more of a cohesive thematic movie, right? Like as we're pointing out, like there are moments of like that's some really good stuff right there. Like that's a great line. That's a great, you know, Eternia saying. Like that's all. I really appreciate that. Like when I was watching, I was like, yeah, that's really good. But as we've been saying, everything just falls flat, and that makes everything just kind of void because they don't do anything with it. I don't feel any like, the movie ends, there's no like resolution where I feel satisfied in any way. I don't feel like anybody's like the teenagers. Yeah, they've gone on a journey, but like very surface level. I don't feel like I care about them by any means. And then He-Man, I don't give a crap about. I want to know how He-Man fits into that. I want to know how He-Man fits into, like, what's the journey that's going to happen next? What was the journey, these journeys that he has been on? And you don't just have to do a flashback. You just, like, you write it into a character that to speak and talk and, you know, like, I mean, we sound like just the broken records with this stuff, but, yeah, I think you needed someone competent, you know, how nowadays guys will, you know, they'll write movies and they'll send it to Fincher or James Cameron, or they send this stuff to Lucas, I know, sometimes, and like, hey, what's wrong with this? Can you just like be a ghost writer and be like, help me figure some things out? Because otherwise you'd get stupid movies.
Yeah. The interesting part about this is the writer here is the writer of Dark Crystal.
Okay.
And so I think, you know, Dark Crystal is a really well-made movie. It drops you into a universe that has a lot of similarities, right? Mm-hmm. With the weirdness of it, and the strangeness of it, the kind of sword and sorceryness of it. Uh-huh. And yet that movie never leaves you in a place where you're kind of not understanding the character motivations, you're not understanding the world that you're in, you're not understanding the heroes and the villains in a better way. I mean, Dark Crystal is a much more successful movie in that sense, from a writing standpoint, you know? And so I think, you know, him coming in to be the guy who writes this script is not a bad call. It just seems as though they were never able to kind of figure out with this film, and maybe it's because of who's producing or anything like that, but they're really just never able to really figure out what the main drive of the film is, other than getting it to screen. You know, we have a popular cartoon. We need to put a live action version out so we can make some money. And you know, I think that's the thing that really kind of hampers the movie. I wanted to ask you about this because, you know, in a film like this, music can matter, and it can, you know, take a film to the next level.
Yeah.
And Bill Conti, you know, who of great fame, film music wise, does the soundtrack here. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, guy's known for Karate Kid and the Rocky films, and, you know, all sorts of great movies. The Right Stuff, goodness. What did you think of his score here for this movie?
Oh my goodness. I don't even remember it. I'm trying to like I don't know if that's a me thing or if you feel similar, where I don't like there. It didn't stick out to me, at least. I could go back and like listen to it to like see, oh, is this actually good? But it didn't. I'm pretty good. Like, I feel like I'm pretty good at, like, when I watch a movie, like, a score does enhance. Like, it really will. I mean, we've talked about this before with different movies where, like, the score really enhances these scenes in this movie, where, you know, a really good score is really good at not just one aspect of, like, major battle, but really good at the quiet, you know, moments. Yep. I don't remember it at all. where, I don't know if you feel the same, but nothing stuck out to me personally. I could go listen to it and see, like, on a music level, I'm sure it's great, because we said Bill Conti is a great composer. I mean, the Rocky stuff alone is just like so special, but I feel like it needed to be more prominent. I needed to feel it a lot more, you know. I need Star Wars stuff. I need the coolest part of this is kind of an off track thing, but it fits within what I'm saying. This is a cool universe because this is like, let's take a sci-fi franchise and a fantasy franchise and just make a baby. Which you can have such cool sounds and things, and you know, we'll talk about maybe in a second the new movie coming out, but I'm just like, there should be this weird amalgamation of Lord of the Rings and the Narnia and Star Wars and Star Trek like sounds all coming together to make one weird baby that just is cool. But nothing I felt did that, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the score here is trying to give you something that sounds interesting, and obviously they want it, like you said. It's very much the thing where it's like you want it to kind of have this Star Warsiness, but you also need it to have like a sword and sandals type of feel to it. And yet I think that the music is never really truly able to shine in the film. And I don't think that the theme itself is fine, but it doesn't feel like, at least in the presentation of the movie, I didn't love the orchestration. There wasn't a deep enough resonance to the music in that sense. You know, it's like you kind of have to go full on rock opera, like you do in Flash Gordon, or you need to be more like a Star Wars, right? Where it's like you embrace the symphonic scoreness of it, which again grounds you, right? And I
Totally.
think, you know, speaking of that, it's like the action and the production of this movie is really hampered by the fact that they don't have enough money to spend enough time in Eternia to make that matter. They
No.
have to be on Earth for almost the entire film.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing that when we talked about the idea of the way in which the script and understanding all of these things, like we are truly earthbound
Yeah.
in this film. And I think that's the thing that doesn't, like, you know, obviously, when you're watching the cartoon, a big part of that is the ability to understand Eternia
Yeah.
and spend time there
Yep.
and be connected to it, right? So that, you know, if Eternia is going to end because Skeletor is going to take it over, you care, you know? You know, with that not being able to be the case in the film, I think the production just across the board, you know, truly suffers because they're not able to really spend enough money or time on anything to make any of it matter in the way you would want it to.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like the production is like, I guess there's moments where I'm like, oh, that's nice. Like the practical effects, that's nice. It's not like great by any means. But I appreciate the effort, you know. And in a CGI world that we live in, I appreciate practical stuff. But yeah, we are spending so much time on Earth that like, I just thought of this. This movie feels like, at least the Earth, feels like an episode of a TV show that wanted to do a styled episode where they're like, we're gonna make our fantasy episode. And like that's what it looks like. It looks like they're sitting in a warehouse with, you know, random props, and they put on cool costumes, which the costumes, I will give them credit, are pretty good. I think they're fine. But it just feels like a TV show that they're like, all right, here's our fantasy episode that we're gonna go all out for. Which for a TV show, that's great, and it's like fun and cute and whatnot, but like for a Masters of the Universe movie, it's not up to snuff. And then I think like the action choreography is just poor. Nothing like, there's no weight to any of this stuff either. Like we could, you know, we talk about like, I've talked about how like Nolan's Batman movies have like some not the greatest like action choreography, but like this is just like boring. And I I need more. Like you said, when you're in an animated TV show, you just, the world feels full. You can do more, obviously. And it's the 80s, and they didn't have a budget, clearly. But just don't make it at that point if you just can't do anything.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. You know, one of the things is that we're just not given the opportunity for any of this to shine in the way that you would want to. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's one of those, it's just one of the aspects sometimes of filmmaking, mm-hmm. right? And it is disappointing that, you know, and maybe this is another thing too, is like at the time, and even today, right, I think there is a desire to put things into live action to make it quote unquote more real. But man, sometimes animation and quality animation is just the way to go. And I think that that's something that Hollywood truly still doesn't even understand, is that animation is a completely valid genre.
Yeah.
And sometimes it serves the story much better than anything else that you could do, even in today's world when you can do anything with CGI.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes animation just makes it feel more real.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think in some ways, you know, I'd be really interested to kind of go back and to watch the animated feature that they did, mm-hmm. For the Masters of the Universe, Secret of the Sword, that was released in 1985,
yeah.
and see what that was like, because it is, man, if you had put, you know, quality animation behind this, it could have been really, really interesting. When you think of like the, what they did with Transformers, right? The
yep.
Transformers, the movie.
Uh-huh.
That would have been a really interesting thing to do. So I don't know. Where do you land on your ratings for Masters of the Universe 1987?
Yeah. I am going to land at a nice, healthy 1.5 out of 5, I'd probably say. I didn't like it. Just no, I mean, you can kind of tell by what we're talking about, but like, not everything's a cult classic. Sometimes movies just suck, and this movie just wasn't great. I appreciate everybody that tried to make a great movie. I'm sure they cared a lot about it, but it wasn't good. It's a far more interesting story of how they fumbled it than the actual movie itself. And I really hope this new one is a lot better.
Yeah.
And I've heard I've heard good things, so I'm like excited, but yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I'm right there with you. It's definitely a 1.5. And you know, I totally understand how people could just love the absolute bonkers nature of this and that, I could see how people could get into that and have a nostalgia for it too, that feeds into that.
Absolutely.
As well. But I think, yeah, it's just one of those movies where a lot of things just didn't work, and it truly was because this felt and it feels more like a cash grab and a desire just to put something on screen without really taking the time to figure out, okay, what's going to make this work. And a big part of that is the Golden Globus issue. You know,
yeah.
Which is, they're the production company. They slapped things on screen and they didn't pay attention to a lot of that stuff. And it's, uh-huh. it's seen throughout a lot of their movies. And so, yeah, 1.5. And like you, I hope the, you know, as we talk about the new one next week, that it's better, but we'll see how that is. But Rye, people wanted to catch up with you. Where would they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Rye Talks Movies, where I'll post all reviews and different fun things. And yeah, you can catch up with me and all that I'm watching.
Nice. Of course, you can find me all over social media under the name Matt Rushing 02. Of course, here on the network, we'll watch great Star Trek talk with Chris Jones. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with two shows. One's called Owl Post, talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then Aggressive Negotiations, talking about Star Wars with John Mills each and every week. But thank you so much for joining us.
Y'all come back now, you hear?